Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, well, we're immersing ourselves in a book that somehow manages to combine, like, existential dread with stick figure drawings and make it incredibly profound.
Yeah.
It's Ali Brosh's Hyperbole and a Half. Unfortunate situations, flawed coping mechanisms, mayhem, and other things that happen.
It really is one of those rare books, isn't it? It sort of defies easy categorization. You might think, oh, it's just funny webcomics.
Right.
But that really sells it short. I mean, it's not a formal academic work or anything, but its core mission is just so important. It's this radical act of normalizing our deepest flaws, you know?
Exactly. Mental health struggles, too.
Yeah, mental health struggles through just brutal honesty and this amazing self-effacing humor.
It really is less about giving you, like, dry information and much more about giving you permission. Permission to feel what you feel. Mm-hmm. The big question Brosh seems to answer for so many people is, how do we take our most embarrassing memories, our deepest anxieties, even crushing depression, and turn them into something that connects us?
Instead of isolating us.
Yes.
Yes.
Instead of isolating us.
And she does it by showing that the strangest, most specific thing the thing you thought only applied to you, it's actually universal. The book works like a mirror, reflecting your own stuff back at you. But it's also a bridge.
A bridge. How so?
Well, it takes you from feeling like you're fundamentally broken or weird to realizing, oh, okay, this is just part of being human.
That makes sense. Okay, so before we dive into the chaos of runaway cake schemes and slightly neurotic pets.
Which are amazing.
They are. Let's talk about Ali Brosh herself. She really kind of pioneered this new form of memoir, didn't she?
Huh.
Through her webcomic and blog, Hyperbole and a Half. Started back in, what, 2009?
Yeah, around then. And what gives her voice such weight, such authority? It isn't like a PhD or clinical credentials.
Right.
Her expertise comes purely from lived experience. She talks so openly about her struggles with severe depression, ADHD, anxiety. And that honesty, that authenticity, it just instantly resonated.
People trusted her.
Exactly. You trust her perspective because she's clearly been there. She describes the internal state so accurately, even the messy parts.
And we have to talk about the style. The visuals are just as important as the words, I
think. Absolutely.
Her drawings, they're deliberately crude, right? Often done in MS Paint. It's the total opposite of slick professional art.
But they're stunningly effective. That simple protagonist, often just a stick figure with that, you know, frantic yellow ponytail.
Yeah.
It became this perfect avatar for these really complex feelings.
It's genius because it is simple. Like when words just fail to capture that feeling of profound apathy or paralyzing dread. That simple drawing with the wide deadened eyes and the crazy hair, it just shows it instantly.
Yeah, it gives a face, a recognizable face to feelings that are usually invisible, internal. And that blend, the simplicity, the humor, and this really profound depth, that's what turned her work into like a cultural touchstone for so many people.
Okay, so let's unpack the book itself.
Yeah.
If you're coming to it expecting maybe a linear autobiography, A to B.
You'll be surprised.
Yeah, you'll be thrown off. It's definitely a genre-defying memoir.
Right.
More like a mosaic.
Right.
Interconnected stories, vignettes.
Exactly. It bounces around wildly, but it feels deliberate. From these absurd childhood moments straight into the depths of adult clinical depression.
And that whiplash, as you called it, it feels like part of the point.
I think it is. The central purpose seems to be destigmatizing mental issues by just putting them on the same spectrum as all our other human flaws and quirks.
Right. It refuses to neatly categorize life. It's not just funny or just sad.
It insists that life is this uncomfortable, sometimes messy, but necessary blend of both. You can't really separate them.
And that emotional journey is key. We start deep in the illogical, obsessive world of a kid's mind.
Uh-huh.
And somehow that prepares us for the, well, the sometimes equally illogical paralysis of the adult mind when it's facing depression or anxiety.
It frames the whole human experience as one of sort of perpetual confusion and flawed thinking, doesn't it? Regardless of your age.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is how that intense, almost manic focus young Ali has on a piece of cake.
Oh, the cake.
It feels like a precursor almost to the intense manic avoidance adult Ali applies to tasks she's procrastinating on. Different target, same weird intensity.
Okay, speaking of illogical behavior, we absolutely have to start with the God of Cake. That chapter is legendary.
It really is.
I bet everyone listening, immediately recognizes that feeling, that pathological, almost criminal obsession with getting that piece of her grandfather's cake.
It's just a masterpiece of capturing childhood psychology. It shows how this intense desire can drive a normally rational person, well, a kid, into these elaborate sugar-fueled schemes that make zero sense to anyone else.
And the denial afterwards, the sugar high, mixed with this frantic attempt to cover her tracks.
It perfectly captures how kids operate outside our adult logic of consequences. They just live in the intense now.
And her ability to deny consequences, it kind of continues, right? In the hot sauce debacle.
Yeah, yeah.
Where she drinks an entire bottle just to prove she's tough for her dad. Internally, she's completely collapsing.
Fine meltdown.
But externally, she keeps up this, like, heroic facade of, nope, I'm fine, this is fine.
It's such a hilarious parable, isn't it? About pride and self-inflicted pain, willing to suffer agony just to maintain an image.
Which, okay, if we connect that kind of flawed childhood logic to the bigger picture, it brings us right to her chapters on adult struggles. Like, this is why I'll never be an adult.
Yes. That chapter validates that feeling I think so many of us have, sometimes well into our 30s or 40s.
Or beyond.
Or beyond, yeah. That feeling of being an imposter, just fumbling through basic adult tasks that everyone else seems to handle with this, like, effortless, natural competence.
That feeling of incompetence.
Mm.
She diagrams it perfectly in her breakdown of procrastination.
The sneaky hate spiral.
Yes, the sneaky hate spiral. I swear, I have never seen a better visual explanation for executive dysfunction, ever.
It is universally relatable. She shows the avoidance, right?
Mm.
Which leads to guilt,
mm-hmm.
which then generates self-loathing, which then, ironically, justifies more avoidance because now you're convinced you're just a terrible failure anyway.
Right. You know it needs doing, but the anxiety around it is so crippling, you just retreat. You end up under a blanket instead.
The lump under the blanket.
Yes. It's the perfect visual signpost for that feeling. You are physically capable, but internally you are just paralyzed by the weight of expectation or fear or whatever it is.
It's such a powerful translation tool. Like, if you listening have ever felt like that immobile lump under a blanket, Brosh gives you the vocabulary. You can actually explain that feeling to someone else.
Which is huge. And speaking of chaos and emotional complexity,
mm-hmm.
we have to talk about the dogs.
Oh, the dogs. The simple dog. And the helper dog.
They're less like pets and more like furry, chaotic, existential metaphors walking around her house.
That's a perfect description. Simple dog is just pure, lovable stupidity, right? A creature totally incapable of abstract thought, a constant source of just low-level frustration.
Then you have helper dog, who's supposed to be the sensible one.
Supposed to be.
But is actually neurotic, destructive, and just constantly defying any reasonable expectation of, like, help or even just normal dog behavior.
The dogs, I think, they serve to highlight the glorious unpredictability of life. And in that chapter, dogs don't understand basic concepts like moving.
Mm-hmm.
She shows how these creatures process big life changes completely differently. But here's the insight, I think.
Yeah.
Caring for these flawed, chaotic, stupidly lovable beings, it forces Brosh out of her own head sometimes. It gives her an external focus point during her own internal emotional chaos. It's like accidental therapy via dog maintenance.
That makes a lot of sense. And that kind of external focus feels absolutely necessary when she transitions into really the core contribution of the book, the two-part depression narrative.
Yes, crucial chapters.
She's so careful in Depression Part 1 to stress that this illness isn't just being sad. It's not even really about sadness for her initially.
Right. She describes it as this profound and terrifying apathy. A numbness. It's a complete loss of feeling, a vacancy, even for the things she used to love and cherish.
And the visual helps so much there. Her comic self with those vacant, deadened eyes.
Yeah.
It helps the people who haven't experienced it maybe grasp that depression is often felt as this biological failure, right?
Yeah.
A lack of connection, not just like heightened sorrow.
It completely reframes the conversation away from just cheer up. And then in Depression Part 2, she describes rock bottom, but also the recovery, which is so bizarre and non-linear.
Yeah, there's no big, like, cinematic breakthrough moment, no swelling music.
None of that. The emotional turning point, the first crack of light, is this tiny, absurd moment. She finds a single shriveled piece of corn under her fridge.
Just a random piece of corn.
And she laughs. She laughs at the sheer absurdity and patheticness of it.
And that tiny laugh over a forgotten piece of corn.
It creates a tiny crack in that wall of numbness.
Right.
And it's honestly the most hopeful part of the whole book, I think.
Why hopeful?
Because it tells you recovery doesn't need some grand epiphany or a perfect therapy session. It can start in the mundane, in an unexpected moment of just sheer ridiculous absurdity, a tiny shift.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit then. Let's try to synthesize what this all means for us, for you listening. If we look at the key themes or messages, what really stands out?
Well, the first, and maybe the most important, is definitely mental health normalization. Brosh just insists again and again that mental illness is a legitimate medical condition.
Right. Not a character flaw?
Not a character flaw. Not a failure of willpower. And by doing that, she gives us this objective language, these metaphors, to describe experiences that feel incredibly subjective and isolating.
Which connects directly to the next theme, I think.
Yeah.
The power of vulnerability.
Absolutely.
By sharing her most difficult, maybe shameful, definitely messy experiences, like the cake obsession or feeling like a failed adult, she proves that vulnerability isn't weakness. It's actually the foundation of genuine connection.
Yeah, things we try to hide are often the very things that link us most deeply to other people if we'd only share them.
Mm-hmm. And we have to talk about humor as a tool for survival.
Yes. She doesn't use humor to minimize the serious issues, does she? Or dismiss them.
No, not at all.
Instead, the humor makes them approachable. It makes them shareable, less isolating. It feels like a processing mechanism, a way for her to look at deep pain without being completely crushed by it.
It's true. Finding some levity doesn't reduce the significance of the struggle, right?
Okay.
It just makes the burden maybe a little more bearable.
Exactly. And maybe one more theme, the absurdity of human logic.
Oh, definitely.
We just have to accept that our reasoning, whether we're kids obsessed with cake or adults paralyzed by email, is often inherently flawed and kind of weird.
And accepting that absurdity, that flawed nature, that's the first step towards having more self-compassion, isn't it?
Totally. Okay. We need to stop judging ourselves so harshly for these common human flaws. We're all just, you know, slightly disorganized, emotional bags of impulses, trying our best.
Doing our best. Okay, the book also has these incredibly powerful, memorable lines. Quotes that just articulate feelings we maybe couldn't put into words before. Let's look at maybe three that really sum up her impact.
Okay. The first one, I think it really encapsulates the compounded difficulty of depression. The shame of being unable to deal with the simple things that everyone else can do is like a second layer of depression.
Oof, yeah, that hits hard. It shows how our own self-judgment and maybe societal expectations, that tyranny of normal,
yeah.
It just doubles the weight of the illness itself.
You feel guilty for being sick?
Exactly. Then there's her direct challenge to the whole just cheer up idea. She says something like, trying to use positive thinking to cure depression is like trying to cheer up a dead person.
Right.
It's not about a flaw in your character. It's a flaw in your chemistry.
That one just immediately validates the biological reality for so many people suffering. And it shuts down that harmful misconception that depression is just a choice or, you know, a lack of effort.
It's so clarifying.
Yeah. And finally, that moment of recovery we talked about. And that's how I learned that you can't be sad and laugh at the same time. Not really. But I was so proud of myself for finding the loophole.
The loophole. That's the critical turning point.
Yeah.
It reminds us, recovery isn't about magically fixing everything overnight.
No.
It's about finding these small, external, maybe absurd loopholes that crack the numbness just enough for you to feel something else, anything else, besides apathy.
So, practically speaking then, how can we actually use Brosh's insights in our real lives? What are the applications?
Well, I think the biggest benefit is giving people vocabulary and self-advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
She provides such clear metaphors, like being that paralyzed lump under a blanket when you lack motivation.
Right. So if you're struggling, you can use that specific, vivid language. You can communicate your internal state to a partner, a friend, a therapist.
Exactly. Instead of just saying, I feel bad or I can't get anything done, you can say, I feel like I'm stuck in a sneaky hate spiral.
And people who've read the book or even just heard about it, they immediately get the dynamic, that paralyzing guilt cycle. That clarity really helps with self-advocacy.
Definitely. Another huge application is reframing expectations.
For ourselves and others.
Both, yeah. The book really encourages us to stop viewing setbacks, procrastination, and emotional slump as these huge monumental failures of character.
Right. View them more as just normal parts of growth, or maybe just normal parts of human chaos.
Yeah. And when you do that, you take immense pressure off yourself and off others too, maybe.
And for people supporting someone with mental illness, it's an incredible empathy building tool.
So?
Well, if you read those depression chapters, you get this visceral window into why some well-meaning, but maybe simplistic, advice like, just go outside or try to be happy, can feel really alienating and useless.
It helps you understand the experience better.
Exactly. And understanding that leads to much more compassionate and probably more effective communication. Right. Less judgment, more listening.
Okay, so we've journeyed from hyper-focused childhood sugar highs all the way to the quiet isolation of apathy and back out through a piece of corn. What's your final takeaway?
My final thought is that Brosh's most valuable contribution, maybe, is proving that the most profound, difficult truths about being human can be conveyed through the simplest means. Right. That those kind of goofy MS Paint drawings can carry just staggering emotional weight. Simplicity isn't shallowness.
That's a great point. For me, what I loved most, honestly, was the sheer validation. That feeling of realizing you are absolutely not alone in your weirdness.
Yeah.
Or your struggles. Or your total inability to maintain a tidy house or manage your ridiculously stupid, lovable pets. She just confirms that embracing the chaos is maybe the only real way to navigate being alive.
That feels right.
So here's a final thought for you to mull over. Brosh's recovery started with a quiet, unexpected laugh over a single shriveled piece of corn under the fridge. What tiny, absurd, maybe unglamorous moment in your own messy life might hold the seed for your next step forward. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.